Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, where is Ferguson today and where is it going 2 years after the Michael Brown shooting? We'll get an update a little bit later. After we go behind the headlines, we'll meet the forgotten man in the absentee ballot flap in the city of St. Louis, and we'll take a look at the Bayer-Monsanto merger to get some sense of what it means for the region. That's where we begin. St. Louis Public Radio reporter Wayne Pratt has been on that story. I spoke with him a few minutes ago and asked how that proposed merger might help or hurt the community.
From what we are being told, it may actually help the community. A couple of headquarters operations that are currently in North Carolina, it appears they will be moving here. They're under the Bayer flag in North Carolina. They'll be coming here. That's the Seeds and Traits Division and the North American Commercial Operations. And when you talk to Monsanto people and some other officials around the community, they are all under the impression that philanthropic activity will continue and the presence will still be here.
Well, that is certainly good news. There is some concern, however, about redundancy, I think they call it, the synergistic issues. They're going to spend $1.5 billion to replace people, get rid of people.
That's what it looks like, yeah. Don. Yeah, you mentioned that buzzword synergy, and that came out in May when it first became public that Bayer was interested in Monsanto. And then in the big conference call they had this week, the CEOs of both companies both used that word. Mm-hmm. And you're right, $1.5 billion in synergies, cost savings, after the third year if this deal is implemented. And that will obviously result in some jobs because a lot of stuff will be overlapping. They're not talking about numbers yet. They're not talking about units they may have to divest yet. They want, for the divesting issue, they want the regulators to tell them what to unload. They think it's the regulator's job, not there to say, oh, we're just going to throw this out there. When it comes to jobs, we don't know numbers. We may have some details next week if some reports are true. We'll see how that turns out.
Well, most of us, I think, remember what happened when InBev came in and took over Anheuser-Busch. A lot of talk about no jobs are going to be lost, and all of a sudden 2,000 people were out of work. So we have that in mind.
We were talking about that in one of our business team editorial meetings this week, that we want to keep a very close eye on the reports coming out of other communities and what may be coming here, because with InBev, it was kind of a piecemeal thing, 40 jobs here, you know, maybe 75 jobs here. That all adds up over time. And I think everybody's going to be alert to that considering the experience we've gone through in this area.
Another part of that equation, as I understand it, is that apparently there is some sort of labor agreement with the German supervisory personnel, which would protect them. A labor contract would protect them from losing their jobs, which would seem to imply that more would be lost here than there.
And that's what we are thinking. There's no clear indication of that yet, or at least, well, let's keep it all in mind here. It's been a positive spin from both companies this week because they're trying to gain regulatory approval. They're trying to keep the shareholders upbeat about this deal. So they're really not going to get into that with too much detail yet. But labor contracts everywhere will be something to absolutely monitor. And we have heard those rumblings that maybe some European operations will fare a bit better than what's over here. Yeah.
I wonder how happy the shareholders actually will be. It's my understanding, you probably know better than I, that actually Monsanto's stock has gone down since this was announced.
Since the formal announcement, it has gone down, but it's also not back to, let's just call it the low point as to when Bayer initially announced in May that it was interested. So there's still a lot of room there to give with the stock price, but it has gone down somewhat since the announcement, but that could go up within a day. You know how these things are so volatile.
It has gone down, but it has gone up since that initial announcement.
Yes, exactly.
I guess is what you're saying. What do both of these parties bring to the table in this merger?
A lot of elements. The seeds division of Monsanto is considered one of the biggest in the world, if not the biggest. Bayer has the pesticides angle on all this, and they feel that they could intertwine very nicely when it comes to what is going to be an increasing global issue of feeding the world with the anticipated population increases and the anticipated farmland decreases. So the farmland we're going to have in, say, 17 or 20 years has to be more productive, and they see this combination as a way to make sure that happens.
What about the bioscience community here, which is fairly extensive? How is it reacting to all of this?
It's been relatively upbeat, but is uneasy, upbeat a term. I guess it is now that I just threw it out there. Everybody is kind of holding back on really coming out and saying, yeah, this is a great thing. From the people we have talked to, it's a good thing. It seems to be positive at this point. We've talked to Bayer officials. They want to maintain the commitment. They want to keep pushing innovation, which a lot of that is done here. But we really don't know how it's all going to shake out at this point. We're still kind of a little uneasy.
There is some concern, though, I've heard expressed from people in this community about competition and costs and the fact that it could drive prices up for things that these two companies, or soon to be one company, I guess, sell.
I talked to the head of the Missouri Farm Bureau this week, and he said that loss of competition is an issue because it probably will drive up prices. But he's more concerned about innovation not being as cutting edge as it has been in the past as coming from Monsanto. And his theory is quite simply, you get a bigger company, they have all these technologies, many of them are profitable, and they want to protect the bottom line. So the innovation speed might not be as brisk as it has been in the past as they try to protect profits. They don't want to replace successful technologies with anything new.
What else are you seeing in this whole transaction that you find of particular interest that would be of interest to our community?
I think that the back and forth over the past few months has been fascinating, at least to me, and that's coming from a Business Observer nerd's view. I guess you can describe me as that. But the original offer of $122 a share, and then there were rumblings that went up to $125, and they finally settled at $128, which is lower than many analysts anticipated, suggests to me that maybe there's something out there about Monsanto that we don't know yet. That will probably come out as all the documents and regulatory filings are issued over the next few months. But to agree to a deal that many analysts think is below the value it should have been kind of fascinates me, and that aspect's being played out right now.
Going back to the potential, I should say, of jobs being lost, one of the things I've also read about this is it would have the potential for putting a lot of new entrepreneurs into this market area, people who might be leaving their jobs at Monsanto, who would be at a stage where they would go out in the whole bioscience realm and develop product themselves. Have you seen that?
It's a distinct possibility, mainly because that entrepreneur infrastructure, so to speak, is so strong here, especially when it comes to the agricultural biotech sector. Yeah. That's a mouthful at the end of the week, you know. Yeah. So that's a distinct possibility, and that could be a positive. But, you know, we get all those buzzwords that come out on this, and startups is one of them, and entrepreneur is one of them. A lot of them are not successful, and we don't hear too much of those. So that'll be interesting to see who does break out on their own and how they develop.
There's a lot of this story yet to be written because there's a whole realm of discussions, negotiations, and with regard to this whole transaction that have yet to be played out.
Yes, and from everything I've been told and everything I've read, regulatory approval is not a slam dunk. No. They're going to have a lot of challenges here. They admitted on the phone call this week that they are going to apply for regulatory approval in at least 30 jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. That's obviously here in the U.S., up in Canada, down in Brazil. The European Union is covered there. And it'll be very fascinating to see what they have to do in order to gain regulatory approval in each of those markets, just like it was with the beer deal that's about to come down and close here in a few weeks.
Yeah, people should not assume that it's just this country that has to approve it.
Exactly. It's going to be some hurdles that need to be cleared everywhere.
One final question. Are we looking to for a name change?
Both CEOs left that option open. They danced around it a bit when they were asked that question, but they left the option open. Hugh Grant, the CEO of Monsanto, went as far as to say it hasn't been formally discussed as part of these negotiations yet, but it's something we have examined in the past, which leads us to believe that they were probably serious about it if last year's deal with Syngenta would have gone through. So there's probably a blueprint there for those discussions. Don't be surprised if the Monsanto name eventually goes away.
Whatever happens, Mr. Grant's going to come out of it okay.
That's what we're seeing. We were going to follow up on that and go through those SEC documents. I'll admit we were beaten to it by another outlet in town. The estimates, I think, are as high as roughly $77 million. That depends on the stock options he has as well. And as we touched on in the conversation, the stock price can be volatile. But yeah, he's going to be okay.
Our thanks to Wayne Pratt for the background on the Monsanto-Bayer merger. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. City Democrats in the 78th Legislative District are going to the polls today, voting again after August primary results were tossed because of absentee ballot irregularities. To date, just about all of the attention has been on incumbent State Representative Penny Hubbard and challenger Bruce Franks. But there is another candidate, the Republican primary winner, Eric Schellquist. He is a graduate student at St. Louis University and has been sort of the forgotten man in all of these goings-on. He'll face today's winner. We wanted to find out how he is responding to this whole thing. Eric, nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you make of all of this?
So many allegations of problems with absentee ballots, and I just want to make sure that we face, in November that we have a candidate that there is certainty that the election was legitimate. We definitely want to have certainty where there's no substantial doubt along who was the legitimate winner. So I definitely hope that we have that certainty, that clarity today.
You know, I've been calling you the forgotten man. and in a sense, you have been, because throughout all of this, no attention has been paid at all to the fact that you also won the primary. Your name is rarely, if ever, mentioned in any of these stories. How do you feel about that designation?
I'm certainly not bothered by it. I mean, I think it's good that, but I do hope to, you know, I would like there to be, everyone to know that there is a choice, that there, in November, that there's a, free exchange of ideas, and that there, the Republicans are here in the city, and, we definitely want to offer our, our side and our, the ideas. We're the Republican Party. We have a lot of ideas, and there's been a lot of criticism lately, especially with the presidential race, of the two-party system being a bad thing. And well, if a two-party system has a lot of disadvantages, a one-party system is even worse. And I think that we should have two or more parties actively involved and competing each time. I think that the more viewpoints we have, the better.
Well, Republicans certainly do have a tough time winning elective office in the city of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. Why?
I think it's hard that sometimes it's hard for us to get our message out. There's negative perceptions of us, but I think if we get a lot of our ideas out and start talking about, Fremont, like, for instance, I'm, an urban planning major. Cities have always been my passion. Like, I think that the Republican Party, we were originally the urban party. And I think if we, are seen as, having more of an urban agenda, something that, and if we can show our love for cities and how we can, they're vibrant hubs, economic and cultural hubs. If we can, just promote our ideas within urban context and with that layers of messaging, I think that's important.
How would you synthesize your platform, your plans for the city, or for the district, if you will?
My plan for the district, I think, would be to, a lot of the issues that we have are with vacant land, and I think that we, I like it's I'm sorry. I think it would be really important to, to bring more energy and more vitality to the urban landscape, with because we've lost a lot of our population over since 1956. We were, we had a population of 856,000, and with grander trends of you know, with suburbanization and with a lot of trends we need to kind of regroup and center on urban vitality.
Right. If you had your druthers, which of these two candidates who are running today in this special election would you like to run against?
Oh, I've been thinking that for a while. I think that, you know, what we saw 4 years ago with, you know, with the McCaskill and Aiken involvement, and with one party actively trying to, you know, influence the other party's primary, that might be inappropriate. But I will say that, you know, that that one of these candidates has, you know, been lots of substantial allegations of election and absentee irregularities has affected their candidacy, and I think that it would be, you know, the candidate that's not been involved in that might be a better choice. But I would not want to improperly try to choose my opponent.
Sure, but nonetheless, in practical politics, you'd probably be better off not running against an incumbent, because incumbency carries with it a certain weight, and more often than not, incumbents win re-election.
True. I mean, Bruce and our friends. He's a friend of mine, and I know he'll do. I mean, he's done so many great things, like in the past several years, and I've only gotten to know him over the past year, but I have great respect for him, absolutely.
One gets the sense that the two of you are probably fairly similar in your approach to government. You have high energy.
Energy, grassroots, you know, South City, we live sort of near each other. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about where I live is, you know, the South City music scene, Cherokee Street. It's getting to be involved in that community is a really great thing. Like, I have had, you know, great relationships there, following all the bands that play in that area. It's it's fantastic.
You seem to have a certain hunger for political office. You run before president of the Board of Aldermen, I believe, recorder of deeds, and now for the state legislature. What's driving you?
I mean, it's important that we you know, to articulate a vision. Like, I, particularly as it pertains to the Recorder of Deeds office, I do think that that ought to remain an elected position. There's been petitions about, first off, there was, you know, the angle of having it be appointed by the mayor and then rolling the functions into the assessor's office. I strongly disagree. Shortly after the election 2 years ago, I met with Ms. Carpenter in her office, and it was
the incumbent. Yeah.
Yes, Sharon Carpenter in her office, and it was originally supposed to be like I, you know, I brought some things, and we were discussing topics related to the Recorder of Deeds office, and but it was originally supposed to, you know, only last about an hour, but we ended up like losing track of time talking about all sorts of things for like 2 hours. I think she missed her next appointment after me, accidentally, and it was. And I really think that should remain an elected office, because she was explaining to me a little bit about the MERS program and foreclosures, and how an independent recorder of deeds with the power to check the improper foreclosures, improper if a landowner you know, loses their property related to property tax forfeiture or foreclosures or anything like that, a recorder of deeds with the independence to make sure that no one loses their home through improper means is important. I think that I encouraged her to, I think that we, you know, we can go kind of deeper down that rabbit hole, like make that a good bully pulpit for strengthening of, you know, rightful land claims.
Sure.
And I think that if it was rolled into the mayor's office, if there was ever a time when the recorder of deeds needs to fight against the municipal government of the city of St. Louis, I think it's good to have it be an independent county function.
So I think you were telling me you were running for Recorder of Deeds so that you could eliminate Recorder of Deeds as an elective office or not?
No. Okay. I would maintain it as an elective office.
Absolutely. My misunderstanding.
I'm sorry.
No, that is my fault. Do you think this whole process since the August 2nd primary helps or hurts you in your election bid?
Again, I think the contest was in pursuit of justice, in pursuit of certainty and clarity about the true intentions of the voters. And I think that his challenge is it is good. I think it is good that if there were improprieties, they are brought to light. And the two members of the board that were replaced by Nixon, Governor Nixon. One of the issues that I think they were serving on expired terms, and I think that is not just pertaining to those two individuals, but as a general principle, I think that terms of appointment to boards and commissions should expire automatically on the expiration date. Like you had it with a few years ago with members of the Public Service Commission overstaying their welcome, their term, and it affected some cases. And fixed terms of office are very important. And, even if it does cause some inconvenience, if the seat is just vacant while no one serves in it, that is better than someone overstaying their term of office. And again, I'm not saying anything about the two specifically who are replaced, but as a general principle, fixed terms of office for boards and commissions are important.
You know, one of the things that has occurred to me with this special election is the fact that it's a Democratic primary. The Republican primary has been held. Mm-hmm. But what is to prevent Republicans who have already voted from showing up and voting Democratic today?
Well, there's nothing really to prevent it. If someone just weighs their conscience and their, the totality of the evidence. You know, there's been lots of coverage in the Post-Dispatch, and if they feel that they, ought to vote for a certain candidate, then
But they would be voting twice. They would have voted in one primary, which is signed, sealed, and delivered, and then turn around and vote again in the Democratic. I mean, theoretically, your supporters could have some influence on who the candidate you would face in November would be if they voted twice.
It is possible and highly irregular, but we need to remember why there is a special election, because the original one was flawed. And I think any time that there's, overturning an election is a weighty matter. It is a very, it's not done lightly. It's before it was done 4 years ago in the 87th district, I believe. Before then, I can't recall a time when that's ever been done. So it's rare and for cause and...
But you see what I'm saying. This would seem to me to be an impropriety, too, if, in fact, and I'm not saying it has happened, but it could, if, in fact, a Republican who cast a vote in the primary on August 2nd decided, well, I'll vote in the Democratic primary and vote for one or the other. That would be an impropriety as well, would it not? Again, I'm just raising the possibility here because
absolutely.
I think it is a possibility.
Sure. I mean, it's definitely a possibility. I think you have to. I mean, you could weigh the relative impropriety of the two things, and in consideration of the totality of the evidence. So
you're not saying one impropriety is less weighty than another, are you?
I think that the second impropriety of the is lesser than what caused the original election to be thrown out.
Well, we don't want to belabor this point because we're not even aware that any of this is happening, but it could happen.
Sure.
I think it's a flaw in the process. That's just my opinion. Eric Schoquist, thank you so much for being with us. We wish you good luck in the November 2nd election. Whoever your opponent happens to be, we'll know that later today, but you are the Republican candidate for the House seat in the 78th District. Thank you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.